Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week, we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today on Baylor Connections is Dr. Helen Harris. Dr. Harris is an associate professor in Baylor University's Diana R. Garland School of Social Work. Before coming to Baylor, she was the first director of Hillcrest Community Hospice in Waco, and she continues to volunteer and provide training to area hospice organizations. Dr. Harris is one of the nation's leading experts on bereavement, grief, loss, and faith's role in processing these things. Her research has covered a wide range of ages and experiences, ranging from children to older adults. Each year before the holidays, her expertise is called upon by publications ranging from the Baptist Standard to Newsday, providing readers with helpful tips as they interact with friends or family members who have lost a loved one. Dr. Harris is with us today on the program. Thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, we gave you a little people a rundown of what you've done professionally, and you've centered your professional life on dealing with topics, quite obviously, that a lot of people don't necessarily want to think about. They're not the most fun topics, but grief and loss are unavoidable. So take us back a little bit. How did your interest in these topics and pursuing them begin?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. I think for most of us, God's call in our life starts both with our personal experiences and our professional experiences. And I was a military kid, so I spent a lot of time in my youth moving, almost every school year, actually. And did a lot of thinking about what it means to have to start over with relationships all the time and the benefits of that in terms of learning how to socially connect, but the losses as well in terms of long-term relationships. Then I went to work at South Texas Children's Home, where I discovered that the kids who were coming to us out of foster care or from their own homes frequently were experiencing not just loss of their parents and being at home, but loss of their neighborhoods and their schools and their friends. And I think that is what kind of launched me thinking more about that, that this is pretty universal experience. And then some of those kids experienced the death of their parents and grandparents, and it was my job to help them with that. So I needed to figure out how to do that.
You know, when you and I talk about loss on the program, we're certainly mostly be talking about the loss of a loved one. But what are some other ways that you've studied that people can process loss, whether it's, like you said, moving and changing relationships or other ways?
Yeah, Pauline Boss wrote some important research about ambiguous loss, what she called non-death loss. And there are really two examples of that. One is when somebody is psychologically present but physically absent. So kids who have an incarcerated parent or a deployed parent in the military have somebody that's present in their minds but physically not a daily part of their lives. And then the opposite of that is people who are physically present but psychologically absent. So what happens if my grandmother has dementia or Alzheimer's disease and is physically there but not psychologically present with me? That can happen with addiction and lots of other mental illness and mental conditions where somebody is physically in the room but really not psychologically engaged. And people experience loss with both those scenarios.
So as we talk about that, we'll be talking more about loss of a loved one, but there's a number of different ways that people can maybe apply some of these lessons or topics in their own life.
That's exactly right.
It's very interesting. Well, certainly in the classroom with Baylor students, you talk about these subjects a lot. And when examining in loss and bereavement, where do you begin? You know, you've got a classroom full of 18 to 22-year-olds, or maybe if they're graduate students, a little bit older, but young people. When you're bringing up the topic, maybe they're considering it for the first time academically, where do you start?
Yeah, interestingly, you know, most adults, young adults, have had some loss experiences already, and so frequently that's where we're able to connect. And if they haven't, they certainly know they will at some point as their parents age and their grandparents are aging as well. And one place to connect is just with what happens in the transition when you move away from home and you engage in your adult life and you're really not going to be going home as a dependent child again.
You worked in hospice care in Waco and then came to Baylor to begin teaching this and various subjects. What brought you from hospice to teaching at Baylor full-time?
Yeah, actually, I got a call from Baylor while I was working at hospice asking me if I would teach the death and dying course or death education course in the health education sequence. So I did that for about 4 or 5 years part-time while I was working in hospice. And then there was a point at which Preston Dyer called. I'm a social worker by profession, and said, you know, look, we have a faculty member who's left. We need somebody to come for a year to fill in. Would you do it? And I said, absolutely not. And he said, would you pray about it? And I said, of course. And you know, as frequently happens, prayer changes mm-hmm. things. And so my sense was that this was where I was supposed to serve next. And my experience is that preparing social workers to do the work is the call in my life at this point.
You came here, but obviously the experiences you had in hospice certainly shaped the way you approach your subjects, your students, what you teach. How has that impacted your work in the classroom?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of these courses are called Death and Dying, and they really should be titled Life and Living, because mm-hmm. death is a part of life. We aren't working with people who are deceased. We're working with people who are alive, who are dealing with the questions of quality of life every day. And I think that's really the key, is to help normalize the experience. This is something that happens in all of our lives and to everybody that we care about, first of all. Secondly, to normalize that grief hurts, and that it's okay to say that and to deal with the healing process following a loss. And I think third, to remember that the quality of life is as important as the quantity of life. So my experience with people who are at the end of their lives is that they really don't have time for baloney. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really focused on the relationships and the conversations and the quality of every day and every moment. So the question isn't how long am I going to live, but how do I make today the very best day it can be? And when we focus on that, whether we have a terminal illness or not, we win.
But there are ways that we as society maybe don't accept the fact that this is normal and that there are healthy ways to process that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. We live in a death-denying society, one that doesn't like to talk about it, and so we put makeup on corpses and we try and, you know, sort of make everybody look as alive as possible and tell people, you know, let's celebrate because folks are in heaven. And I'm not against celebrating heaven, but I do think, you know, when people go to heaven, they aren't with us here in the present. And so experiencing the importance of remembering them well and celebrating their lives in ways that acknowledge that it's hard for us when they're not here on a day-to-day basis is really important for us to do.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned those. Or can you delve even more into some ways that we as a culture can approach these ideas healthy, whether it's with an elderly relative or maybe just getting to know someone who's older?
Yeah. I would really encourage folks to remember that older adults have a great deal to teach us, a great deal of wisdom and knowledge and life experience to teach us, and we don't have to be afraid of them. And we also don't have to be afraid of the older adult who asks the same questions multiple times. Understanding that every time we respond, we've engaged them positively. More important than that, though, I think is the opportunity to say today is the day we have together. And so the stories that people have to tell, the memories and lessons they have to tell, are a gift to us rather than an imposition on our time.
Dr. Harris, you know, you mentioned, you know, adults, maybe older adults, asking the same questions over and over. There are a lot of things associated with aging that could be frustrating for the older adult, but perhaps frustrating to children or younger people as well. When you talk to students about that, maybe as they eventually watch their own parents age or maybe their grandparents, approaching that in a healthy manner, maybe honoring the fact that you says it is a natural stage of life.
Well, I think also to know that the stories that older adults have to tell and the memories they have to share are treasures. And, you know, part of what I say to folks when someone has died is, as families gather together and begin to tell the stories, you know, we sit together in the funeral home during visitation, or we sit together at our houses during meals, and someone will say, well, I remember when Uncle Joe said so-and-so, or do you remember when this happened? And those are chances to capture family history and understand family legacy, and we need to be writing those things down. The chance to sit with an older adult who's much more connected sometimes, and there are a lot of well older adults who don't ask the same question mm-hmm. over and over again. I need to say that, but the chance for people to tell their story that connects with our story as well. Family legacy gets lost when we don't hear the stories and write them down.
Were these topics, before you moved to the academic side of things, were these topics you were considering regularly when you worked in hospice?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was, you know, part of it's actually a therapeutic technique called life review or reminiscence. And so the chance to sit with people and say, tell me about when you were young. Tell me when you and your husband met. Tell me what your courtship was like. Tell me about your job. Tell me how you experienced World War II and what that was like when you guys were separated. And absolutely. I think that's what helps people understand not why they're dying, which is really not the question, but why they've ever lived, what meaning their life has had.
How did those experiences in hospice shape your academic research pursuits? Were there ideas that you witnessed working in the field that you thought, when you moved to the academic side, boy, I want to study that further?
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that Charles Kaur writes about a lot is that grief affects us in every dimension of our lives. So it has a physical impact. We really can struggle with our immune system and multiple illnesses. And I mean, we really need to take care of ourselves physically when we're grieving. It has a spiritual impact, which you can imagine, how could God let this happen in my life? It has a social impact. The people may not understand what we're experiencing. And it has also a cognitive impact. And people who are grieving can have trouble learning new material, trouble with short-term memory. And part of what I observed is whether it's children having school performance issues or older adults who suddenly think, oh my gosh, is this the dementia 3 months after their spouse has died? People who are having cognitive deficits in the wake of a loss really struggle with what does this mean. And I started looking at the research, and it showed that lots of kids who've had a recent loss are diagnosed with ADHD. So my question is, if the cognitive impact of grief and loss is poor attention, poor concentration, impulsivity, difficulty in school, which sounds a whole lot like ADHD, then the question is, do those kids really have ADHD, or is that the cognitive impact of loss? And what do we need to know about what's really happening with them so we can treat them appropriately? So that's a good bit of the research I've been involved in, both with children and with adults.
What are some of the findings that have stood out most to you?
Yeah, universally, that's the report. I have trouble with memory. I have trouble thinking. I have trouble with short-term memory and concentration. I watch my favorite TV show, and at the end of it, I couldn't tell you what the plot is because my mind is somewhere else. And with children, what I'm learning is that this is not just about death-related loss, that it's really about ambiguous loss. And sometimes the kind of chaos that children are living in, particularly children in poverty who move a lot or who are dealing with an incarcerated parent or divorced parents and they're having to move as a consequence of that, that it's nobody's fault, but it is true that those kinds of disruptions seem to make it more difficult for children in terms of their school performance. So the question isn't, it is, what is happening with them and how do we best help them be successful?
You know, later on in the program, I want to ask you how we individually and culturally can serve people dealing with loss. And while we may be thinking more about families who have lost an older adult, I want to include that in that answer as well, because that's certainly an important topic. We are visiting here on Baylor Connections with Dr. Helen Harris, Associate Professor in Baylor University's Diana R. Garland School of Social Work. And Dr. Harris, how does being at a school like Baylor, you mentioned the faith component, when we talk about issues like life, loss of life, there's a spiritual component. How does being at a school like Baylor, where you can really talk about that and study that academically, affect the work you do?
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that people draw on the resource of their faith. And so how they make sense out of the suffering they experience, how they make meaning out of the losses they experience are really important resources for them as they move forward. It's also true that church is community for us, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk about our church family, for example. So there's some real practical ways that churches can be helpful to grieving persons. I recommend to pastors and churches that there's a big bereavement calendar somewhere in the church, because we do a really good job in our culture of showing up at the time of death. We do a good job of lots of food and casseroles in the refrigerator at the time of the funeral. And usually for maybe 6 weeks after the death, people are asking, how are you doing, and checking on you. But then everybody gets on about their busy lives. And the truth is that loss is one loss after another for the whole first year after the death. So my birthday, his birthday, our anniversary, the 4th of July, the family reunion, Thanksgiving, Valentine's Day. I mean, it just, you know, goes, yeah. It just goes at Christmas. It just goes on and on. So, you know, facing those days without the person who's meant so much to me is another adjustment. If someone in the church reaches out to me and just sends a card and says, you know, recognizing that next Thursday is your anniversary and this will be really different for this year, and I just want you to know I care and I'm praying for you, and if there's anything I can do, give me a call. Mm-hmm. Or I give them a call and say, I'm just checking on you today, and, you know, it's probably a sweet day, but maybe a bittersweet day as well, and just want you to know I care.
That's great. That's great. Talking to Dr. Helen Harris from Baylor's Diane R. Garland School of Social Work, and you are one of a number of professors in the School of Social Work whose work involves older adults. Dr. Preston Dyer, Jim Eller, Dennis Myers, all of you have different aspects from which you approach older adults. How does the work you do complement the work they do, and how do each other's work impact how does the work you all do impact each other?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's wonderful, not only about the School of Social Work, but about Baylor is access to so many incredibly wise and gifted and knowledgeable people. And so working with colleagues who are so smart and so accomplished and so knowledgeable is a real gift. You know, Dr. Dyer's expertise is in the area of marriage, and his ability to think about and talk about and teach about marriage throughout the lifespan and the transitions that happen in marriage and how we can support married couples is just invaluable. Jim Eller's work in crisis and disaster management and older adults in the wake of crisis, his work with the folks at the West Nursing Home after the explosion there, his work with older adults in the wake of Hurricane Harvey in Houston and other flooding times and in Texas has just been phenomenal. He's really tuned into what happens to people in the time of crisis and really the dangerous increased mortality rates of folks in crisis when they're older if there aren't lots of resources and help and support for them in all those transitions. And of course, Dennis Myers is absolutely committed to caregiving and to understanding how families can come alongside the older adult and continue to be family and deal with role transitions and role differences and how we work together as adult children with older adult parents. And so, you know, I count on them for the ways that they understand these nuances of the experience.
Y'all have something to share with each other that can enhance your own understanding.
Right. They teach me every day.
That's great. Well, talking about teaching, looking back at your own research, what are some of the more practical ways that you've seen your research applied, whether it's by individuals or organizations? What are some of the ways that people outside the academic community have been able to experience the work you've done?
Yeah, one of the things I think that's probably most important is the conversation that normalizes grief. So there are lots. I volunteer with my church and with one of the local hospices. I see folks who are dealing with complicated grief. So grief when there's been a relationship disruption or trauma involved in the death, and in those circumstances, it really sometimes takes some counseling and therapy to work with the trauma. Where in what we call kind of normal grief, it really is a matter of helping people understand that when I'm wounded, God has given me the capacity to heal. In fact, in every area of our bodies, just think about it. If there's a wound, the healing happens naturally. If I have a cast on my arm or stitches in my hand, it's not the cast or stitches that heal. The healing comes because my body is able to knit back together again. That's a God-given trait. What makes that possible is the support of the stitches or the support of the cast. So the question then is, who do I have in my life that can support me, kind of hold things stable for me while that healing that God has already provided happens? And I think, you know, being able to communicate that and say to people what you're feeling is normal and natural, and it doesn't mean you're crazy. If you thought you heard your husband's car come up the driveway last night and you thought you heard the door open and close and it's just been 2 months since he died, that doesn't mean you're psychotic and having hallucinations. It means that those memory tracks are so ingrained that you re-experience it as though it's happening again. That's normal, and it's okay. Now let's talk about how you feel when that happens and how I can support you through that. So you don't have to pretend like it's not happening and you don't have to freak out when it's mm-hmm. happening.
So by affirming those feelings, you can really create a place where healing can take place.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that support that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. you know, that you're not alone. You don't have to do this alone. I care about you. You will be okay. But it's never going to be like it didn't happen. Right. So the memory of that person is always going to be important to you. Just like, you know, once my cut heals, there's a scar there. It's always happened to me, but it's functional. The tissue is functional again.
Well, Dr. Harris, as we wind down, we're heading to the final moments of the program. You've given us some really tangible ways that we can approach these topics, and thank you for that. But I want to ask you, you know, we started off the program by talking about dying, loss, bereavement. Aren't necessarily subjects that people always want to think about, but we all will eventually. But I want to ask you, as you study these topics, how do you stay hopeful? You know, in sometimes bleak parts in people's lives, that's what you're looking at. How do you stay hopeful? What gives you joy as you approach this?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. One is, as I work with people who are at the end of their lives and people who are caregiving for people who are at the end of their lives, I see more courage, more strength, more giving, more compassion than in anything else I've ever done. It's a blessing to me to see people engage life every day. When people despair of life, I want them to remember that the value of the moment is what matters. You know, if I can't remember your name, but I remember the moment when we connected and our eyes met and we cared about one another, that's life. Mm-hmm. And so I think seeing that happen with other people is what keeps me energized. The other side of that is I really do know that there's life beyond these bodies. And mm-hmm. God has given us the promise of eternity with Him. And I really don't want to stay here till I'm 300, you know, especially aging at this rate. the promise of eternity with Him and with one another is such a gift that the Lord has given us.
Well, Dr. Harris, thanks so much for sharing these thoughts with us today. I think some really valuable insights and stuff that people can apply in their own lives, and I thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Helen Harris, Associate Professor at Baylor's Diana R. Garland School of Social Work, our guest today here on Baylor Connections. Thank you for joining us. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online, baylor.edu/connections, and you can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks for joining us on Baylor Connections.